Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Wednesdays, welcome the Dakota Political Junkies. This week on deck, we have Jonathan Ellis, reporter and columnist for Argus Leader Media in Sioux Falls. Jonathan, welcome.
Hey, thanks, Lori.
Also with us, John Hunter, publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. John, thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Thanks.
All right, so today we expand a little bit because Governor Mark Dayton from Minnesota is going to announce who's replacing Senator Al Franken, and of course the big news out of Alabama that Roy Moore was defeated. The first thing I want to talk about, though, is how this all connects with Senator John Thune, because if you weren't paying attention on Friday, he came on CBS this morning, talked to Gayle King, spoke out against Roy Moore, and really talked about character in Washington with a little twist at the end of the conversation. Take a listen.
Can we just turn to the resignation of Al Franken yesterday? He said the irony is not lost on him that the man who was bragged on tape about his history of sexual assault now sits in the Oval Office. What do you say to that now that it looks like Roy Moore might be coming to Senate?
Well, I mean, I think there are men across all kinds of different industries that are learning that there are consequences to bad behavior, and I think that's a good thing. You know, what happened yesterday is unfortunate in the Senate, but I think on Capitol Hill, the discussion that we're having right now is long overdue.
Yes.
And I think what it points out is that action is needed. You know, we can't continue to accept the status quo there or anywhere else for that matter.
You had called for Roy Moore to step aside. That clearly is not the case. What will you all do if he's elected?
Well, I think the one thing I've said all along is if he comes to Washington, he'll immediately be under an ethics cloud, probably an ethics investigation, the result of which could be recommending expulsion, could be recommending censure. There are different things the ethics committee can conclude. But it's a huge distraction. I mean, the simplest, wisest thing for him to do in the best interest of the country and our party is to step aside and allow another Republican to get into that race, because I think we would win the seat.
And yet the RNCs are supporting him.
Yeah.
Well, and that's unfortunate. I don't condone that. I think they made the right move in the first place.
All right, Senator. Very good.
Yeah, good to have you.
Very good to
be with you all. Thank you. Merry Christmas.
Nice to see you in person.
Yeah, likewise.
Look as good in person as you do on TV.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Gayle.
Welcome.
And it's right there at the end, isn't it, Jonathan Ellis, where she takes this conversation about sexual harassment and character and says, hey, you look just as good in person as you do on TV. What are your thoughts, Jonathan Ellis?
Well, that was sort of an odd departure, given what they were just talking about. I think we've reached a point where you have to be very delicate in the way that you talk about people and their appearances, and so that I was kind of caught off listening to that. I was sort of, it was very abrupt, and I was pretty caught off guard by it.
John Hunter, consequences to bad behavior for people across all kinds of industries, and Senator Thune not afraid to say that that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think he's standing for what he believes and saying it. You know, regardless of kind of consulting with others, and so he's right, at least in my opinion, that that people are recognizing that that the wrong behavior does have consequences to it, and so I think this is a good movement as it is, and awareness will bring, I think, reduced bad behavior.
John Hunter, do you have any thoughts on the fact that U.S. Senator John Thune sort of spoke out for Roy Moore to step aside? It didn't happen. He spoke out fairly frequently about this. Now, as of today, it looks like Roy Moore is not headed to the Senate, and a Democrat will join the conversation instead. What does it mean that Senator Thune wasn't really listened to with what he was saying, and how does that play forward?
Well, there was certainly mixed approaches about Roy Moore. I mean, there were certainly Republicans who said, including John, who said early on, look, you should step aside, put another candidate in there. It's a strongly Republican state. You know, another capable candidate could have won the seat. In fact, as late as last week, I think some people thought that they could nominate someone who hadn't campaigned and still win that. And so, again, I think, on the other hand, some people were endorsing them, and certainly voters were pretty close to split. I mean, it was a very close election, and some people said, remembering that Roy Moore had denied these accusations, and so you have people saying one thing, and who do you believe? And some people believed Roy Moore, other people believed the accusers, and so that's how you kind of get the split thing. But I'm glad that Senator Thune said what he did, and it's something I think he believed, and I hate to make every decision in the world that we do either have an R or a D after it, and I think he just took a principled approach there.
Jonathan, not too long ago, we had Seth Tupper on the show, and he was talking about some work he had done looking into how much money Senator Thune has in his campaign war chest and how that money was used. Let's change angles here a little bit and look at former Senator Tim Johnson and what we know about his leftover campaign funds.
Well, yeah, and this is the Rapid City Journal giving them the credit on this, that they had done some reporting that Senator Johnson, who retired after the 2014 session, still had a fairly substantial amount of money. I think $800,000 is what they had reported, which, for a Senate campaign isn't a ton of money. But, and so he's been able to use that money, and we saw that in some ballot issues. He's been able to support some ballot issues in the last election cycle, and also trying to get some ballot issues qualified for the 2018 cycle. So he's used that. He's also donated to the state party, which he did very loyally throughout his congressional career, which started in 1986. So I mean, he was always the Democrats in federal office were always very good supporters of the state party. And that's continued even after he's left office, which, frankly, the state party has really needed. So, it's not uncommon for politicians when they retire to have money in their accounts. Bill Janklow, for example, when he left office in 2003, had 2004, but he had money in his account for many years up until right before he died, and he used that money then to help set up the archive of his papers and things like that. So not uncommon for retired politicians to have money and then to be able to kind of dole it out as they wish.
John Hunter, what are the rules and what are the expectations from donors?
That's a broad question. Laurie has a lot of answers, but the rules have changed. That there was a time, and I think there were some grandfather clauses to this, but there was a time when people, candidates, when they retired, could keep the money and spend it on fast cars and cabins in the Black Hills. And so they have tightened those up and said, no, it needs to go to other campaigns or to nonprofits and so forth. I'm not very specific on the rules, but so the things that Senator Johnson has spend it on, I think, fall within the framework of that. I don't think anyone is suggesting otherwise, that if you donate to other campaigns, to the state party, to his alma mater, those sorts of things, I think, are all within that realm of that. Second part is, what are the expectations of donors? And I think that's depends on the donor. I think there are a lot of people said, hey, I gave this for this particular campaign, it should be returned if you don't use it. Other people say, look, I trust Senator Johnson, use it as you see fit, that sort of thing. So that would clearly depend on the donor. I think there's the uncertainty of how much money maybe that final campaign will cost. If you have a close race and then you kind of spend it all in order to win that last race, it would be a different story than if you have a huge lead, you're a popular candidate and you don't need the money that people have sent in to you, then you have this, theoretical problem. It's not too big a problem, but I think donors are mixed on what they would like to see done with the money.
In theory, someone who has a large fund like U.S. Senator John Thune and the interest of that money is of how that money has been invested, could go in some ways could go on indefinitely. If he decided to retire early, does he have years of influence in front of them with the way he spends that money out? I know that's not a realistic scenario, probably, Jonathan Ellis, but it's an interesting one to sort of contemplate what that money could mean from a candidate in the future, how their legacy can continue.
Yeah, I mean, and Senator Thunes is fairly substantial now, at $12 million or so, somewhere in that area. And as you indicate, generating a decent amount of interest income. You know, I mean, you're right. In a small state like South Dakota, and part of the rules are, I mean, they can donate to other political campaigns, and there are, of course, limits to how much they can donate in a campaign cycle. But, you know, in a small state like South Dakota, certainly that would be very influential. If you look at that in the grand scheme of things, though, that's like a drop in the bucket in terms of how much money is actually contributed by, you know, if you look at, you know, all the PAC political action committees out there, all of the special interest groups that raise money, I mean, $12 million is really not much money. But for one person to be able to exercise and just, you know, dole that money out to their favorite causes or political allies, yeah, I mean, that's something that would be very influential, again, especially in a smaller state like South Dakota, if the money came here.
Let's hop over to another border state and talk about Iowa, and a little bit, let's start with you, Jonathan, because Dana Ferguson did this piece in the Argus Leader, talking about an editorial Governor Dugard wrote to the Des Moines Register. Lay the groundwork for us here, Jonathan. What happened?
Well, the Des Moines Register, which is in is also a Gannett-owned paper, like the Argus Leader, had written an editorial criticizing a state senator there who wanted to basically do away with the income tax, and they would do away with that and I think replace it with increases in their sales tax. And the Des Moines Register is opposed to that plan pointed out South Dakota's reasons to be opposed to that plan, saying that, you know, we rely on sales tax and, you know, it's a regressive tax, and as the editorial said, we just don't want that. They called us the Wall Street or Wall Drug state. So Governor Dugard responded with a lengthy letter defending the state, defending the state's fiscal health, and taking a kind of a, you know, defended a Wall Drug as well, and suggested, made a pitch for their maple donuts and 5-cent coffee, and then at the end of the letter suggested that they would be much better off being more like South Dakota than Illinois, which is a disaster right now in terms of its budget. So yeah, it was characteristic Governor Dennis Dugard type letter.
John Hunter, it's a lot of fun, but there's also some serious, you know, conversation here at stake when you talk about taxes and tax reform in the state's economy.
Well, it's something I think it strikes home with Governor Dugard is that's right. I think as much as anything, that's what he's tried to do is be fiscally responsible, and he's very proud of the AAA rating and doing things financially strong, balancing with ongoing revenues, meeting ongoing expenses. So it's close to him, yes, and it does have a little fun with that. But that's maybe what governors should do, right, to step up and defend quickly, right? You know, you don't wait 6 months. You just turn back and and more free speech, right? I mean, that's respond to that, and so I think I was glad he did that. I don't know how he would know that was referenced in the first place. Maybe there's some really good clipping service or something in the governor's office, but I don't know if he reads the Des Moines paper every day. But that's I'm glad he did it. Yeah, it was good defense.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about some other conversations in the state, and this one is about agriculture and immigration and folks doing a sort of virtual march to talk about the impact of immigration reform on the state agriculture economy. John Hunter, do you want to give us an overview of that?
Sure. You know, South Dakota farms and ranches occasionally rely on immigrant labor, and the discussion here is to let's have a plan where we can have legal, reliable immigration laws that will help agriculture in the future. Agriculture certainly is less of an employer due to automation and all that sort of stuff, but it's still, especially certain crops and certain livestock require more labor than others. And some of the farms and ranches are having a dickens of a time hiring people, and whether they're unavailable or unwilling or whatever to do that type of work, and so have been able to fill in some of those gaps with immigrants, and they want to make sure that they don't get into a situation where they're would hire illegal people. They wanted this to be legal and reliable and all the good things. I think it's a good move. It's a little bit, I think, geared toward the future. Maybe it's not a critical issue now, but it sure could be, especially with the widely polarized discussion about immigration. If we had something that was reliable and legal and all buttoned up tightly, that South Dakota agriculture would benefit.
So are they saying that something has changed that is at risk here, that it was doing well and is no longer, or are they just trying to be part of the overall conversation about immigration reform so people don't forget that this is what it looks like on a dairy farm in South Dakota, for example? Jonathan?
Well, what I think is
changed. Oh, go ahead, John.
Oh, sorry. No, Jonathan, you go.
No, okay. Well, no, there will be debates about immigration, and that's been going on in Congress. Their contention. I think they would prefer the status quo with regard to H-2A visas that allow for temporary workers to come in and help in agriculture. But they would prefer if they could in this this debate that'll take place, if they could make reforms in that H-2A program in which you don't have to have necessarily just seasonal workers, but more longer-term workers. So, instead of seeing the program go away, I think they would like the status quo, but if they had an opportunity to actually expand the program, they would like to see that happen for more of a, more of a stable workforce.
John, what has changed? You were going to say? How is it different?
Well, maybe I was just going to make up something. I'm not sure.
Okay.
No, I think what has changed actually is in South Dakota agriculture, where, I think there were 10 years ago, there was very little immigrant labor in the state. Most of that, when we think of that, is going to be workers in California and in fields that need to be handpicked that they have not yet invented machines for. And for corn and soybeans, that's never really been the case in some crops. But I think, especially as the kind of the growth of dairy is kind of a big deal, even though that has a lot of automation in it. And I think to a degree, also what may have changed is new workers' attitudes toward farm work. Maybe there are a lot of people who grew up on farms, didn't mind farm work, maybe liked it. And as we become a little bit more of a population shift to the larger cities, that there may not be as many available workers who are either used to that or would like that.
John, does this tie into the conversation about visas for seasonal workers in the Black Hills and the tourism industry? This is something that's year-round, though, on a dairy farm, for example. Are they the same conversation, or are they different?
I think it's a little bit different. That seasonality is, to a degree, tied in the Black Hills a little bit with the school year as well. And so I think they have so far been able to rely on kind of school, college students and so forth who could kind of fill that. Whereas I think a lot of the agriculture tends to be either the year-round, as you described, or sometimes with harvests in the fall. So I think there's a little bit of a different seasonality. But that's, tourism all over America faces that same issue, whether you're at Wisconsin Dells or you're at the Golden Gate Bridge or wherever. So that's much more a kind of a all-nation issue, I think, the tourism seasonality than agriculture.
We'll continue to unpack that in the future. John Hunter, publisher of Madison Daily Leader, thanks so much for being here with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Lori.
Jonathan Ellis, reporter and columnist for Argus Leader Media. Find his work at argusleader.com. Jonathan, thanks again.
Hey, thanks, Lori.